Thank you very much, everyone, for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here. It's my first lung conference ever after my baby was born, so I'm really happy to have these days here with you. And this work was done with very special people, so I like it very much for the result and also for the joint work that we have together. But before I start talking about the work itself, I would like to make some advertisements, so I apologize for that, but I think it might be good news for some of you who want to visit. So, University of São Paulo is based here. It's one of the largest cities in the world, and it's also one very important university in Brazil. It's where David Bohm was when he wrote his 52 paper. That's why I was looking for pictures of him to put here. São Paulo itself is not a very particularly beautiful city unless you like concrete and traffic jams. But it's a place where everything happens. If you want Amazonian food Monday, 2 a.m., you will find it, and you just bump into really cool stuff all the time. So for you that like big cities and a lot of stuff to do, it's a really nice place. And beside that, we are close, very close to really nice places. So we have a lot of beaches around, very beautiful places, and we have mountains. And we also have Guarulhos International Airport, which is the airport that your connections, wherever you go to Brazil, it's very likely that you have a connection through this airport. So if you ever visit Brazil, instead of just doing a quick connection to Guarulhos Airport, stay a few days and come visit us. We'll be happy to have you there. And our campus is really nice. It's a really big university, a lot of green, so it's always pleasant to be there. It's like a relief when you move out of the city and enter the campus. And we have 60,000 undergrad students, 30,000 grad students, 5,000 professors. And we are responsible for around 18% of publications in the Brazilian community. So we're actually a very important university in Brazil. Okay, so this is our group. We have two postdocs, three PhD students, and a lot of master's students. It's a really nice group. We are very happy to work together. And we have continuous funding for master's, PhD, and postdocs. So if you have any interest in visiting us or spending some time working there, just let me know. And we also have a lot of initiatives in Brazil for funding. So we have national, we are starting to have a national initiative in quantum technologies. So we have this São Paulo Quantum Initiative, QTIA. And we have one of the most important funding agencies in Brazil, and now this funding agency has a special line funding for quantum technologies. And to finish my advertisement, I would like to let you know that we have an opening under this initiative for a five-year young investigator position. It's a leading investigator position. And the salary, I don't know if you are aware of reais and dollars conversion, but it's around the same value that a young professor gets as he gets a permanent position. So it's a very good salary. And with other types of funding attached to it. So, and you can go to any research institution in the state of São Paulo, not only the University of São Paulo itself. So it's a very nice opportunity. If you're interested, also let me know. Okay, so now advertisement is over. We can start talking about the work itself. And here should be non-contextuality, okay, but never mind. So this work was done in partnership with these people here. This is Marcelo Terra Cunha. He was my PhD advisor. And he was also the PhD advisor of Cristiano Duarte and Roberto Baldijão. And Baldi was then a postdoc at my group, and Rafael was doing, did his master's in my group, and he's now working with Ernesto in Portugal. And that's why I like this work a lot, because it's a family thing. Okay, so what is the problem that we are trying to solve? So our everyday experience is classical, and I completely missed the words, you can see that. Contextuality is a non-classical feature, and we know that quantum theory is contextual. So in some sense, we imagine that classical limits must kill contextuality in some sense. So that is the question that we are asking here. Does contextuality fade out under classical limits? And that's, we have a partial answer for that. So my talk is divided in three parts. First, I'll talk a little bit about quantum Darwinism. And then I'll talk a little bit about Speckens contextuality, which I imagine most of you are already aware of. So I'll give just a brief introduction. And then I'll jump into the results that we have relating both. Okay, so the idea here is that we are trying to learn something about some system, but we are not allowed to interact directly with the system. We are going to interact with an environment that is interacting with the system. So for example, if you're reading a book, you are interacting with photons that interacted in the past with the book, so you can get this information. And more importantly, different people that are reading the same book can agree on the information that is stored there. So we want to extract information from that, and we want to analyze if different observers will agree on the information that they are getting from that system. So very, very, very simple example. Imagine that you have system A, and here some system B, which I'll consider the environment. And you have some kind of dynamics that will take these states into these states here. So the environment always starts in zero, and then it will evolve with something like this. Then if you have the initial state in some superposition, the system you're interested in, which is system A, the joint system will evolve something like this. If you make a measurement on system B, you have outcome zero probability A given by alpha, and result one given by probability that's given by beta, which is just the same as measuring system A directly. So very simple example. And then you can also imagine that you have a lot of bobs, and they are all interacting with system A, giving some dynamics. And then you have an evolution like this, and you also have these measurements on system B will give you the information about this measurement on computational basis on system A. So this is what we would like to have in these quantum Darwinism proposals. But things do not always go like that. So you may have something that goes like this, and then this information about the measurement on computational basis in A is not fully stored on your system B. So in this case here, you will have not full information about this measurement on system A. And if you have something like this, besides not having full information about A, if the different bobs measure their subsystems, they may not agree on the information that they get because they may have different outcomes for their measurements. So this is what we are trying to understand. Given some dynamics, I want to understand if this information is well encoded in systems B and if they agree on the outcome that they see. Okay, that's the question, the main question. Okay, so this is called environment as a witness dynamics. So you have CPTP map that takes you to, from system A to the environment. And you generally choose a subset of the pieces of the environment, and you look at the reduced state of this subsystem. So what we get is just the trace, the partial trace, over the rest of the subsystems, and after you interact with system A. So you have system A, it interacts with all the bobs, which is the environment E. Then you trace out most of the bobs and just get a subsystem of bobs. And we are looking at the reduced state of this guy. And we want to know if the information about system A regarding some measurement on system A is stored in this subsystem B. Okay, so the main result of this paper, let me go back a little bit just to show you the paper. This is the main paper that we take as our approach to quantum Darwinism. And the main result of this paper is a concentration result. And it tells you that if the number of bobs is much, much larger than the number of bobs that you are considering, then there exists a measurement, a POVM, on the A subsystems such that with high probability you have something like this for the reduced density matrix of the bobs that you are focusing on. And this means that the information about this measurement on subsystem A is somehow encoded in the this density matrices of Bs. How it is encoded, how well this is encoded, will depend on these matrices here. Okay? Okay, and the most important thing is that this measurement is, it only depends on the dynamics. It does not depend on the subsystem that you chose. So that's why they use this word quantum Darwinism, because the dynamics selects the observable, the information that is going from A to the subsystems B. Okay, so you have the reduced density matrices of bobs that you're interested in. It's like this. And this tells us that this kind of dynamics in general leads to some kind of agreement. People in the quantum Darwinism community use this word objectivity. I don't like it, but I'm obliged to use it because it's already mainstream. But I prefer to use the word agreement. They agree on the observable that they are having information about, because this is independent of the bobs that you're looking at. Okay, so in our example, you have something like this. The information that is encoded is about this measurement with these projectors here. And in the second example, you have the second state. The formula is not appearing here. But instead of one, you have plus. So the information, how well the information is encoded depends on these states here. So we see that here you can actually distinguish these states, so the information is well encoded. And here you cannot distinguish these states, so it's not as good as in the first case. Okay, so now we have a portion of bobs, and we will, inside this portion of bobs, we will see which is the state for each individual bob. So I'll trace out everything else, and I'll just keep one of the subsystems of the environment. And then I'll have something like this. So this is the partial trace over all the other bobs that I'm not interested in. And with this, we can now define what is quantum Darwinism. I will say that a quantum Darwinist process occurs if these guys here encode well the information about the level K. So I know that from the BHP result, pH result. I know that the observable that is getting encoded in the bulbs is the same, but they may not agree on the label K that they will see if they perform a measurement on their system. So I'll say that quantum Darwinism happens if this states encode well the information about label K, which is the same thing as saying that they are sufficiently distinguishable. What sufficiently means will depend on the application or what you want to do. Okay, so we define this Darwinism process with distinguishability eta as, this parameter eta, if the probability of guessing of distinguishing these states sigma is larger than eta. Okay, so this eta will tell me how good my quantum Darwinism process is. The idea here is that in general people want this thing to go to one. Okay, so here our eta is equal to one because these states are perfectly distinguishable. And here, this is not the case anymore because I cannot distinguish perfectly these guys anymore, okay? So what we have, this kind of dynamics, plus good enough encoding, it's what we call quantum Darwinism with this parameter eta. And when this happens, the different bulbs acting on their subsystems are likely to agree on the information that extract about system A. That's the idea. And they call this objectivity of outcomes. And I generally just call this agreement on the outcomes because they are measuring something to extract information about A and they are agreeing on the thing that they are seeing. Okay, so our idea is to relate this with contextuality, so we will use the generalized version proposed by Spekens, which I imagine most of you are already familiar, so I'll just give a brief introduction. So in this scenario, you start with an operational theory, a list of preparations, a list of measurements and possible outcomes for these measurements, and a rule to compute probabilities. So given preparation B, preparation P, and measurement M, I want to know which is the probability of each outcome. Okay, there is an error here as well, but I think you understand what I'm talking about. And this is the most abstract way of talking about a physical system. You're not interested in particular states or measurements or the mathematical objects that will represent this. I'm just looking at the probabilities of outcomes given the preparations. And we have some relations that we call equivalence, and we say that two preparations are equivalent if they give the same probabilities for every outcome of every measurement. And we say that effects are equivalent if they give the same probabilities for every preparation. And now we would like to have sort of classical explanation for these probabilities. And we start with, and for that we will define what is an ontological model. We start with a classical measurable space. And each preparation is associated to a measure over this measurable space. And each effect, each outcome, is related to a response function that is always positive and sums up to one. So this response function will tell me the probability of having outcome B, given that I have the ontological state lambda in my measurable space. And I would like to recover the probabilities that my operational theory has with this ontological model, so this relation here must hold. Every operational theory has an ontological model, But sometimes this notion of classicality, we want these ontological models to satisfy extra assumptions that are natural for classical, in some sense, explanation of these probabilities. So what we want here is what we call a non-contextual ontological model, which is a model that preserves equivalences. So if we have two preparations that are equivalent, the measures related to them have to be equal. And the same thing for effects. If we have equivalent effects, the response functions have to be equal. OK, so this is what we call a non-contextual ontological model, which is our notion of classicality. And we know that sometimes quantum systems will not be explained by this kind of ontological model. OK, so now the work itself with these great people, Roberto and Rafael were the ones that lead this project. So many thanks to them for that. And what we want now, just to summarize what the idea for this project was, is that why people are caring about quantum Darwinism in some sense, because it will give an idea of a classical limit of the information spreading across many, many different observers or many environmental subsystems. And in some sense, people like to associate this with an idea of classicality, but it was not very well understood what this classicality means. So what we wanted was to give a precise meaning for this notion of classicality using contextuality. So that's what we wanted to do. So we deal with this BPH approach to quantum Darwinism. So we imagine that we have environment as a witness dynamics. So this dynamic selects one observable, and the information about this observable is encoded in the bobs. And each bob will have his subsystem in an ensemble given by these density matrices here. And in quantum Darwinism, the important notion is the distinguishability of these matrices here. So our first result regards the relation about how these matrices are in the space of matrices geometrically, and a non-contextual model for these bobs. So if these matrices form an affinely independent set, then we can construct an ontological model for the information that each bob has from subsystem A. So this geometrically thing related to the linear algebra of the system gives you a non-contextual model for the information that bob has. And bob can measure whatever. And this still holds true. Our second result, this is the easiest part. This was the hard part, and it was done by explicitly constructing an ontological, non-contextual ontological model for the probabilities that each bob has. And the second thing that we have is that there exists a bound such that if the probability of distinguishing these states is above this bound, this is a non-trivial bound, we have a formula for it, I will not go into the details, this set of states must be affinely independent. This was kind of the, Baudieu will kill me saying that this was easy, but the most important part, I think, is this result here. Okay, so what do we have as a main result? If we have this quantum Darwinist process happening with parameter larger than this probability, this p hat that we have, then each Bob can construct a non-contextual tautological model for the respective scenario. So what we conclude is that if this quantum Darwinese process happens with sufficiently high distinguishability parameter, then we can construct a non-contextual model for that, for the probabilities that each Bob has coming from the information from A. And this is important because we now have a clear notion of what we call classicality in these Darwinism processes. And it was not clear before that. So many people claim that quantum Darwinism led to classicality, but we didn't have a proper notion of classicality. And now we our contribution is in that direction. Now we have a clear meaning of classicality to use to understand this kind of scenario. So the idea is simple, we're just combining the two lemmas that we had before. If this happens, then we have affine independence. And if we have affine independence, we have non-contextuality. And it's important that these models are explicitly constructed. Okay, what is the problem of all of these things? The question that naturally arises is if we get a specific dynamics, what can we say about that? Non-contextuality emerges in that specific dynamics. We cannot answer that yet because all of our results are based on the BPH formalism, and the results in this work, they are results on concentration of measure. So with high probability, this will happen. With high probability, this other thing will happen. And we cannot say that if you get some dynamics, it will be inserted in these cases. Maybe you're just choosing the one that it doesn't work. So the summary of what we have done is to show that non-contextuality generically emerges out of quantum Darwinism. And here we are always imagined that the number of divisions in your environment is very, very large, and you're selecting a very small piece of it. So in some sense, we are considering infinite environments. And it's not a necessary condition. Darwinism is not a necessary condition for the emergence of non-contextuality. It may emerge even if you don't have a quantum Darwinism process. And we would like to understand this gap is something that we don't know. And we put a meaning to the word classical in this kind of work relating quantum Darwinism. And in finite environments, which is the natural question, of course, you don't have infinite environments in general, you have constraints on the kind of contextuality that may emerge, which is something that we also need to go deeper to understand it better. And we have this cutoff, this p hat thing that tells us when non-contextuality will certainly emerge. And this is a not trivial cutoff, so it's a very interesting result as well. Okay, so we have a lot of questions regarding this project. First, understand if we can do the same for other classical limits. And understand what we have to require from the dynamics in order to see this non-contextuality emerging. And the one that is the central part of interest for us now is to explore this in special cases. So we don't want to talk about probability of having that or that. We want to get specific dynamics and try to understand if that specific dynamics will exhibit this kind of behavior. And now we have this ongoing project on that is the master project of Filippi, co-supervised by Naim, which is a postdoc at our group. And it's a joint work with Roberto, which is now in Poland, Rodrigo, which works with Marcelo Terracunha at Unicampi, and Fernando Iemini, which is a professor at the Federal Fluminense Federal University. Okay, so that was it. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer that.
Any questions? Yes.
Thanks for the talk. My question is about the, so you said that when you have higher eta, you have more non-contextuality, right? And this higher eta is also like the more agreeing. But I wanted to know, like, in a process, this eta is defined as like how those matrices can be distinguishable.
Yes.
And then it feels like if all of the bobs end up in the same state, you kind of have more classicality. But if the, yeah, and like in a process, how this is chosen, if it, they're going to end up in the same state or not.
Okay, that's a good question. First, Marina was an undergrad student at our group, and she's now here, very proud of her. And thank you for your question. So the this property, let me go back to some of. So this is the eta that we are talking about. So is the probability of distinguishing between those states. Which, if you remember the examples, in the first example would be distinguishing 0 and 1, or the probability of distinguishing 0 and plus. So the idea here is that these states, they only depend on the dynamics, both these probabilities and this. Of course, it would depend on the initial state of Alice and Bob, which is something that I didn't mention very explicitly. I should have. But this, we always assume that they start uncorrelated, and we generally assume that the subsystems B start in state zero. You're kind of trying to copy the information on A to these subsystems. And this only depends on the dynamics. So this is something that will only depend on the dynamics. And it is measuring some sense how good you are copying the information regarding that thing on the subsystems. And that is kind of the intuitive idea why this should be classical, because you are just copying exactly the information regarding that specific measurement. This is also important. There is just one measurement that I'm getting information about. I cannot get information about Z or X measurement. I have to choose one of them. It also depends on the dynamics. So if I change the dynamics, I change the observable I'm getting information about. And this eta is measuring how well this information is copied along the subsystems. Is it clear?
Other questions from the audience here? Yes.
Is there a difference between a non-contextual model and a non-contextual ontological model?
No.
Okay.
That was a straightforward one, right?
Yeah.
Other questions? I have a question. So there's this condition on affine independence, and there's you can only have a set of affine independent up to a certain number, which depends on the dimension. So mm-hmm. how what intuition or what physical meaning on dimension follows from that?
I have never thought about it.
You see, because if you have too many states, larger, then they can't be all.
Be.
And also, finding independent states can be cloned probabilistically. Mm-hmm. It's so that could be something.
It is related for sure with this cloning thing.
I see.
And we actually mentioned that in the end of the paper, the relation about this, but I don't remember at all what is written there. But we can talk about it
okay.
later.
Okay.
But it certainly has something with the dimension, so you have to be like up to the system A dimension.
Yeah.
You cannot have a POVM with hundreds of outcomes. Mm-hmm. And but again, these are necessary conditions. Again, they are sufficient conditions. It doesn't tell you that if you have like a huge number of outcomes, you won't have that.
I see.
It's just, and maybe Roberto and Rafael may add more to the discussion, this specific discussion, because I've never thought about that before. But I don't think it's something that is related to some physical constraint. It's just the way that we constructed the proof. So it might be that you also have non-contextual models for that situation as well, but our proof does not apply.
I see. Okay. Are there other questions from the audience here? Maybe questions or comments from the people online? You can speak up, if so. No? So let's thank Barbara again. Thank you.